Welcome to Regulated and Relational, the bi-monthly podcast produced by the Attachment and Trauma Network. Today, Ginger and Julie are joined by Leonard Webb, a retired law enforcement officer who is directly addressing the school-to-prison pipeline by providing equity-based and, dare we say, trauma-informed solutions. Let's listen in to this important conversation.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back to Regulated and Relational, our podcast produced by the Attachment and Trauma Network. I'm Ginger Healy.
And I'm Julie Beam.
And we're excited to share with you from both our personal experiences and our professional knowledge what it truly means to be attachment-focused, trauma-informed, and how we can help children impacted by early childhood trauma. Today, we want to dive into a very important topic, the school-to-prison pipeline. We have a special guest here in our studio to help us do that. I would love to introduce Leonard Webb. We're glad to have you here. Welcome.
Thank you for having me. I look forward to the conversation.
I do too. I'm going to read your bio to everybody. Leonard Webb is one of the foremost speakers on the school-to-prison pipeline. He has used his experience to provide practical approaches to address reductions in the overall use of exclusionary discipline, but also focuses on the issues of implicit biases and structural racism. Mr. Webb retired from law enforcement to focus on improving the educational outcomes of students and improving relationships between administration, teachers, parents, and students. He is focused on directly addressing the school-to-prison pipeline by providing equity-based solutions, bringing accountability to school leaders while increasing attendance and decreasing suspension and expulsions. His work with schools and the community led to him being appointed by Governor Hogan to the Juvenile Justice School Board for the state of Maryland. He offers a unique perspective on the school-to-prison pipeline and solutions. He spent 19 years as an adjunct professor at Potomac State College of West Virginia University, and he spent 27 years with the Federal Bureau of Prisons counseling men. Leonard highlights the pressing need for addressing school discipline issues, building administration, teacher, parent, and student connections, and nurturing students' purpose to help end the school-to-prison pipeline. He provides coaching and strategies to young people to break this cycle and to focus on academic success and resilience. He consults and trains educators with strategies to help them connect with students, focuses on student strengths, and provides support that improves behavior rather than relying on discipline. We are so glad to have you here today. We really, truly do believe that this is such an important topic. So, Julie, I'm going to pass it over to you to get us started.
Well, welcome, Leonard. And I know that we are going to want to know a little bit more about your story, but I really want to start with making sure that everybody understands what we mean when we talk about the school-to-prison pipeline. We all do, but we're not sure that all of our listeners. So can you just define that for us? Talk to us about what that is.
Sure. The first thing I like to say, it's not a cute metaphor. It's an actual thing that happens. And it's systems and policies in place that remove children from the school building and place them in the criminal justice system. And it's usually by zero tolerance policies and having law enforcement in the building. And it predominantly affects minorities, children with disabilities, and LGBTQ population that are most likely to be disciplined, more harshly disciplined and more harshly punished for behaviors that used to be handled in the school building.
And so we have seen a rise of this over the last few decades, and it's continuing to grow, correct?
Correct. School exclusion is the pathway to prison, is what I've learned from my experience in law enforcement.
So what you're saying is that one of the common denominators of the folks who are currently imprisoned is that they, at some point in their school lives, were excluded, were pushed out.
Yes, it's been my experience. I was counseling men in the prison system, and at the same time, I was an adjunct instructor at a university. And what I noticed was these are the same kids and young men that are coming in my office at a prison that are coming into my classroom. And it just led to me, why is this happening? It had me to think underfunded schools lead to overcrowded prisons.
Say that again so that everybody catches it.
Underfunded schools lead to overcrowded prisons. The young men that were coming into my office at the prison had some learning difficulties, and they had bad experiences in school where they were getting pushed out, expelled, sent to alternative schools. And the young men and ladies that were coming into my classroom, they had some experiences, but there was an intervention in there somewhere. There was support systems in place somewhere. And that led me to that underfunded schools, because the guys that came into my office at the prison came from underfunded schools. Mm-hmm. And the ones that were on the college campus, the majority of them had schools that were funding mental health programs, had support systems in place, had high parent engagement. It dawned on me that, you know, there's a connection there, that the dropout rate, when the experience is bad at school, you tend to drop out. You don't want to go. You have high absenteeism. And instead of systems in place that would support the family, there were systems in place that were punishing families, that were taking these things to the court system rather than trying to find non-consequential solutions.
I mean, talk to us about that. Why doesn't that work? I think it's a good idea for us to be very clear what works and what doesn't, and why it works and what doesn't. And you have this really important, unique perspective, because you've been on both sides of it, where you've been in the prison seeing what happened, and now you're on the other side seeing what happened. So you're able to connect the dots probably better than anyone I know.
The discipline issue in education is systematic. We went from a history of people that weren't allowed in schools to separate but equal. And then we said, integrate, and they'll automatically be equal. And in 2023, we're more separate and more unequal than we've ever been, even in the 60s. With the funding of schools and the support systems, it's worse than it was in the 60s, which is really incredible to say, but it's a real thing. The solutions has to address more than the students and their behavior. It has to address all the participants, the administrators, the principals, the teachers, and dealing with certain things as biases that affect how we react and how we deal with people of different populations. I believe infusing trauma-informed responsive principles while showing some empathy, which zero tolerance policies don't work because they're non-empathetic, and using less of exclusion. And it's the only way to really reach young people whose brains are developing and learning how to deal with relationships.
Couldn't have said that better myself, Leonard. That's exactly what we believe at ATN. And it's hard for us sometimes when one teacher in one classroom is really trying to go down the trauma-informed path and getting the training. But she or he is often sort of adrift in that system, right? And until the principal and the building are able to change their culture, until the administration is able to see what's going on there and change the system and help shift the biases and the things that need to be shifted, it's hard work, you know, even from the inside out. If you're, you know, a classroom teacher or, you know, one person who sees that this is a problem.
I think when people hear trauma-informed care and social-emotional learning, they automatically go to mental health, that there's an intervention. And those things aren't interventions. Those things have to be part of the culture of the school. It has to be part of your classroom. It has to be part of, from the moment somebody comes to your building and rings the bell to come in, it starts right there. It starts with how you greet them. It starts with, is this a safe place for a parent to walk in? Does a parent feel safe to discuss some issues they may be having? Does a child feel safe walking in the building? Do they see themselves in the building? Often when I visit schools, what I have them do is close their eyes and imagine that they were a child walking into that building, and to describe what they see. And do they feel affirmed? Do they feel like they're represented? Mm-hmm. And most of the times, they don't. One school I was at, the minute you walk in, there's a football uniform. Uh-huh. The minute you get in the office, there's football decorations. you walk into the hallway and there's academic success students that are getting above average scores in the SATs, that are getting accepted to colleges. And there's pictures of alumni from the 30s and 40s. You walk down the hall and there's more sports pictures. Well, if I'm a student that doesn't play sports, pretty good student, a B plus student and a minority, do I feel like I belong there? So It starts at structural things. It starts as, how do you greet people that come to the building? I've rang the bell at many schools and they've said something like, what do you need? And that's where it starts. How can I engage as a parent in a school that isn't welcoming to me?
I've been thinking a lot. You and I had talked last week in prep for this, and one thing has just been resonating in my mind that I want you to really dive deep into. And it's this statement that you said to me that if a student, you know, is expelled, enters prison, and once they have done that, it's no longer scary to them. So they have this mindset of, actually, I can get what I want, live my life in a way that, you know, you said something like, live it up, you know, for 5 years, because now I know if I have to do 20 for it, I can. That blew me away, just that idea of, you know, we're using fear as a discipline technique. I've got my air quotes going here. And there's so many reasons why that doesn't work. But yes, this was such a stark example of us going about it the wrong way. So can you just walk it through, talk all about that? Because I have really been sitting with that all weekend.
We've tried this way that we're doing right now with the 80s, The war on drugs, in which fear and anger led us to mass incarceration. Yes. That the drug lords and the welfare queens were going to ruin the nation. And the fear and anger led to these mandatory minimum sentences, and it didn't work. And what hurts me the most is we didn't have to do it this way. We don't have to be at this point, especially after the pandemic and how much we've learned about trauma since the pandemic. This could have been a renaissance, but there was a rush to get back to normal, to get back to what we decided the normal could be. And in my experience in the prison system is they were getting younger as I was getting older. And what I learned from them is they're learning at a younger age, I can do prison time. They fear the strip searches. They fear the, you know, maybe gang activity at first. But once they're inside and understand, sometimes there's even a sense of family in there. You have people that acknowledge you that are going through the same thing, and it builds a culture. And it's no longer something to be frightened of. It's something that, you know what, if I get locked up, I have people to send me money for commissary. I have people that will come visit me. I have friends inside, and that outweighs everything that I've had on the outside. And I think people don't understand how poverty and violence injure the brain to a point where, you know what, taking a chance of selling drugs and getting a 20-year sentence and having 5 years of where I'm comfortable, where I can give my mother money, where I can pay some bills, and that sense of empowerment is worth it. Is worth it. At least I did something with my life that if I didn't do this crime, I would have never been able to do in their mind. And that's how the poverty and violence injure the brain, because they think that's their limit is what they're doing. And the incarceration part is just part of how it's supposed to be.
Well, and it's predictable, right? If I go to prison and I find out that some of the things I feared aren't as big and scary as I thought they were, then it is predictable and safe. I have a schedule. I know I'm going to get fed, all of those things that maybe my life isn't predictable on the outside at all, you know, because of my circumstances and because of the way the violence and the poverty are. And that coupled with the fact that I got pushed out so that I didn't get the education and the community and school that I could have had in what we would consider a perfect world, a trauma-informed, trauma-responsive system, I don't see myself being able to go down a path where I can financially, you know, survive and be successful any other way, right?
The ironic part of it is that as soon as they enter the prison system, and someone that was in my position, I had a week to give them an educational assessment. Mm-hmm. And if they had any type of learning difficulties, it was mandatory by law that I offered them evidence-based programming every 6 months of their sentence, whether it was 2 years or 200 years. Mm-hmm. Every 6 months, I had to at least offer it to them. And they had to sign that they declined that. And then I think about, how did they get to prison in the first place mm-hmm. with these issues not being identified? How did they even get to high school with these issues not being identified? And then once they get to prison, there's a law that says I have to offer it to them every 6 months that they're inside a prison. Where does that happen in the school system?
Right.
How many kids are getting assessed that have learning difficulties and we're just putting it off as misbehavior? We're not leading the way in education anymore. We're picking a group of students that comply, that are what we deem as good students. Some of them are just sitting there complying with the rules, not really getting the education. And we're hurting them as well. Mm-hmm. While this group that we're determining, since they don't comply, they don't deserve to be in the school system. And we don't dig deep enough into the trauma that they've experienced. We don't dig deep enough into the effective strategies to help them cope with sometimes normal adolescent things. Mm-hmm. And the higher the adversity they experience, the higher the dropout rate.
And you also touched on something that really struck me, and I know in my core to be true, and that's that sense, that need of belonging, that they are so desperate for that, and maybe unconsciously, but that they can find it in prison, which is a draw, you know, and that is something that can be facilitated and should be facilitated in the school setting and everywhere else. Like, to have that be a draw to prison is so painful to think about, mm-hmm. you know.
I tell administrators all the time, you can't suspend your way to a positive school culture. We have great principals, we have great administrators, but I think the exclusionary has made it too easy for some, and removing kids from school, it's been too easy. Mm-hmm. Classroom management has gone away. It's become call the school resource officer, relating to the kids have gone away. And I use what I call a risk. And I tell teachers and administrators, you need to take the risk. And what the R stands for is real relationships. It's, I have students that say, Mr. Webb, can you do a TikTok video with me? Now I can't dance and I have no rhythm, but the relationship's there where they want to include me in something that's important to them. And building a real relationship starts with what's important to you. I want to get to know you on another level aside from teacher student. I want to get to know what makes you tick, what helps you learn. And young people appreciate that. That goes into their brain awareness rather than compliance. And then the I stands for intentional actions. Being intentional with your time, being intentional with your resources, with your students, with your students' families, with everyone involved. Sometimes it's just a matter of making a phone call at the beginning of the year saying, hey, I'm happy to have your child in my class. And if there's anything you can tell me that helps them learn, anything that you can tell me that they like, any help that you can give me to support you through this journey, just being intentional. And sometimes our biases don't allow us to be intentional because we have these thoughts in our head, this child isn't meant for college, mm-hmm. or this is the way that they act. Or another popular one is they're on free and reduced lunch. So how do they afford those shoes, or how do they afford that phone?
Oh, wow.
Mm-hmm. All that affects our relationships. All that affects our actions. Then now they become unintentional. and they become unconscious. And the students notice that. And the S stands for safe spaces. And if your school doesn't feel safe to them, if they don't feel represented, if they don't feel like they matter, then it's not a safe space and they're not going to talk to you. And the only way you create safe spaces is by intentional actions and real relationships. A is just simple. Keep asking questions. That just keeps the conversation going. That keeps an open line of communications that lets them teach you how to teach them. Let them help you understand them. Let them help you understand how they learn. And it all takes a risk. It takes us out of our comfort zone, but that's what the risk means.
Wow, that's so powerful. It's actually, in a way, simple. You know, I mean, it's the shifting of the focus and the shifting of the paradigm and just what are we doing? What's working and what's not working?
And we jump in and we think the trauma work starts with the students, but the trauma work actually starts with the adults in the building.
Sure does.
And what triggers me? Mm-hmm. And how does that affect my teaching and my learning and my relationships with students? If we don't start the trauma work with ourselves, we can't have the trauma work with students. Mm-hmm. Trauma-informed care and social-emotional learning are the foundation of what we do. It's not interventions.
That is exactly it, because that's exactly why students are getting expelled. It's not necessarily what the student did. It's that the reaction from the adult led to that. Their level of tolerance, their level of acceptance, their level of understanding.
The system's culture and supports, right? If I've got a student in my classroom that's struggling and I have 26 students and that student struggles daily, it becomes a struggle for me and everybody else in the classroom. You know, and where are the resources that I can turn to as the classroom teacher to get those supports? So back to what Leonard had said about underfunded, under-resourced schools, you've got to have the resources and you've got to have a plan on how to execute them, right?
And I understand there are assistant principals out there who are changing diapers and it's hard to fill the positions and there's a lack of subs to count on, but there's a better way to do things. Mm-hmm. And we still haven't recognized getting away from the old way. We're still doing curriculum over everything and testing and rigor over relationships. If we improve those things, then the curriculum comes easy.
Right.
And I think that's where the fear and the anger comes in, is that we've been doing it in a way for so long that people are afraid to do it different. Some are angry that they may have to adjust what they're doing. That may go against some things that are biased that they haven't handled yet. You know, I'm 55 years old and learning to cope with trauma has been a lifelong process. And we're asking adolescents to do it.
We're asking elementary, you know, like little kindergartners. We're not just asking, they are having to deal with it because they've had traumatic lives, you know, and more so since the pandemic. I have a question that somebody posed to me that still bothers me, and I'm going to pose it to you, and it has to do with resource officers in particular. I agree with what you have said, that, you know, the presence of resource officers is problematic for a lot of students. And when I raised that as a possibility, what I heard back was, as a school administrator, the absence of school resource officers is problematic for, you know, the parents and some of the adults that work in the building because of, you know, school shootings and other dangerous kinds of things. Can you weigh in on that? Like, I get it. I get what the fear is, but, you know, how do we help shift that culture so that it isn't problematic for our students?
School resource officers have never prevented a school shooting. And I understand that. The counterpoint of, well, they'd be less harm done, but we don't know that. The biggest problem I have with school resource officers is that law enforcement, and I've done training in law enforcement for years, law enforcement do law enforcement things, and they look at things through a law enforcement lens. So it's no longer disrupting the classroom. it's disturbing the peace in the mind of a law enforcement officer. And if they're not properly trained on social emotional learning, if they're not properly trained on trauma-informed care in the school, then they're going to react as a law enforcement person does. Mm-hmm. There are first graders across the country getting handcuffed. You may have helped the classroom management, but you've traumatized that child for a lifetime where they didn't participate in the sing-along. Mm-hmm. I was at a high school once, and a child was late, and I watched them get yelled at the minute they left their car. Whoever drove them to school was late for work because they were late getting ready and they had to drop them off at school. So I know they heard all of that on the way to school. They get to the front desk and they have an attendance person there that is rude to them, that talks about how they're always late. And then the Pledge of Allegiance comes on over the loudspeaker. And the child is trying to get to class so it doesn't stop to stand or, you know, put the hand over the heart. The school resource officer stops the kid and gets into an argument over standing for the Pledge of Allegiance. If you're there to stop school shootings, why are you intervening in something like that?
Mm-hmm.
That's a discussion that could be had somewhere else. But too often, school resource officers, especially in underfunded schools, are finding themselves into hallway monitors, into bathroom monitors. Since they're not trained on child brain development, they go right to their law enforcement lens. And once it escalates, once they're not shown the proper amount of respect, it now turns into a criminal incident. So if you're going to have school resource officers, and I've worked in a prison for years, and we've had local law enforcement come into the prison, and never has a local law enforcement officer witnessed the fight and intervened, because that's the warden's building. Mm-hmm. And the warden's employees will take care of what happens inside the prison. Mm-hmm. You don't have those privileges as a law enforcement officer on the outside to walk into a prison and start delving out punishment and discipline. And it should be that way in the schools. The principals own the building. The school resource officers need to know that principal's idea for teaching, what their view is, what their lens is, they can properly go about their duties. If it's there for security, then you do security. Make sure the door is locked. Make sure that, you know, the weapons are accounted for, or whatever that is. But these are the only reasons you walk into a classroom. Mm-hmm. These are the only reasons you talk to a child. And that only should be is to say, good morning. I hope you're having a good day. Not let me search you and all that other stuff. Right. That's what happens. And law enforcement, I've had them myself come in with their own prejudices and their own biases. And if they view something as rude or out of line, when that becomes a conversation with a student, nothing is protected. That conversation isn't protected. And it just leads to bad situations that could be avoided with proper classroom management. You don't call a school resource officer because a child's not doing their work. The child doesn't stand for the pledge. Right. And that's what's happening. These minor incidences are turning to criminal offenses. And it's with our most vulnerable children. It's with our children that have some learning difficulties that law enforcement, and I can tell you from 27 years, federal, state, local levels, that we're not trained on.
Exactly.
We're not trained on that stuff. They play school resource officers, usually low man on a totem pole. And if you do certain things, you can get out of it. So the next low man on the totem pole with the least amount of training, with the least amount of interaction with youth, with the least amount of education are placed then. Right. Now, there are school resource officers that are doing a great job, but they are doing it in schools that are funded, that are funded well, and their roles are distinct as more coaches and counselors rather than security.
So you can take, you know, in a trauma responsive culture in your school, and assuming you have the resources and funding to help you make that shift, you can take your SROs and actually utilize them in a trauma-informed way is what you're saying.
For parents, it's good to know who's paying for them. We taking out of our school budget to pay for these school resource officers when we could be paying for mental health education, when we could be paying for mentoring, where we could be paying for family support, where we could be paying for culturally relevant interventions rather than a salary for a school resource officer to sometimes just monitor the bathrooms, just monitor the hallways and wait for the next school shooting based on fear that it may happen. Yeah. Where is that money coming from? If it is coming out of the school's budget, I have a big problem with that, especially when they're not trained, especially when schools are already underfunded.
And when we know that relationship is a huge key component to the answer, and classroom ratios are so high, and there's all kinds of things that could happen to give the students more adults in their environment to relate to, that were trained if we had the resources there.
You look at the school shootings over the last 20 some odd years, that out of the, I think it's almost 2000 that we've had, that one was an LGBTQ student and four were students of color. But if you look at where school resource officers are located, they're located in those schools, the ones that are least likely to have a school shooting.
Well, thank you. I don't disagree with the things that you've said at all. And I hadn't really thought about it from the community pressure standpoint, but that was really this guy's point was, he was getting pressure from the families and the community about wanting that safety for their children. And I think that in part, it was because they didn't understand.
In the history of school shootings, they are planned. Typically, they're planned out and they have distinct targets. It's not something where you can predict it. You can put people in place at the right time, at the right moment. They've already decided that it's going to happen. A lot of school shootings already have school resource officers in them. And in some situations, the school resource officers didn't have the training for a school shooting. So right. They didn't know what to do either. And you have instances of prevented school shootings by gym teachers, mm-hmm. by math teachers. And why is that? Because they have relationships that better handle the situation. Even in law enforcement, when there's a situation that involves hostages, you don't go in shooting. The sure. first line of defense is to negotiate.
Yeah. We had a beautiful example of that. Oh, it's probably been, it may have even been a decade ago here in the Atlanta area with a office worker, somebody in the school office able to, engage the potential shooter, for a long enough time that everything worked out and that he ended up backing off of his plan. And it was just because she was devoted to doing that negotiation and to having that conversation and, to opening to that relationship. And it was, it was eye-opening. She didn't have any particular law enforcement skill. She just saw the situation, understood about relationships, and, jumped in.
If you have properly funded schools, strong social emotional learning component, and trauma-informed care, mm-hmm. you don't have to worry about school shootings. It's a safe place.
This whole community focus is so important, and you've given us a lot of really good tips and everything, but are there things that you haven't said yet that you'd like to say that we can put into place now? This whole, shift and looking at prevention is so powerful,
How do schools get started down this path? I feel like if we've got listeners at various levels of schools listening to us at this point, and they're like, all right, so what can we do? What are some of our first steps?
For schools, is start with the trauma-informed care. Start with recognizing the signs and symptoms of trauma. Mm-hmm. Take steps not so you don't re-traumatize the children in your school. Make sure any approach you have is collaborative. That includes parents. That includes the students. And you listen to their concerns. And then it's an integration of knowledge of trauma. And make sure you're using that in your interactions with your youth and the families. Mm-hmm. For parents, You have to be that parent that the teacher knows your email, the teacher knows your face, the principal knows your face. And it's easier than it used to be when I was growing up, because there are parent teachers, and if both parents worked, or if you only had one parent that worked, you couldn't get in contact. But now we have Zoom, we have all types of access to build a relationship. And just like teachers, your first call should be to the parent saying, you know, I'm happy that I have your child in the classroom. As a parent, you shouldn't be waiting for that call that says your child's in trouble. Your first call should be, my child's in the classroom. This is what they like. This is how they learn. This would help them. I'm open to anything. You can call me anytime. I'll get back to you. Is building that relationship foundation first. And then for a parent, knowing your school's disciplinary policies. Mm-hmm. And if they changed, why did they change? Knowing some of the numbers and the figures of suspension rates, who's getting suspended and why. Parents are sometimes negligent in letting the school take care of everything. And parents need to be more proactive in learning those things. I know school board meetings in Maryland, you can watch them over YouTube. You don't have to actually be there. If you miss it, watch it on YouTube. We're not parenting. We're letting our children go to school to be parented and hoping a finished product comes back in some cases. And we need to be better at parenting. And for the youth, it's also understanding what's your school's policies, building relationships with your teachers, understanding that there are going to be biases and learning from the past. I know Florida's trying to cut out everything about history, but it's even more important for students there to learn about the past, the systematic things that went on, and learning how to cope with those things, being able to ask for help. It starts at the very basic levels of building relationships and then allowing that to grow. We just have used punishment as a default to everything, and it doesn't work. We've already seen it doesn't work. As a country, if we're going to be the leaders in education, if we're going to end the school-to-prison pipeline as a country, we have to start putting people in places and boards that are going to fund things appropriately, that are going to look at things from a lens of what happened to you, not what's wrong with you. It seems like a lot. It's not easy, but it's simple, I like to say.
Yeah, I would agree. It's simply getting back to what humans are, which are relational beings. But you're right, it's not easy in a system that, you know, has got so many components to it and is already, you know, set up to go a certain direction. To like dismantle that and push it another direction is hard work.
That's why your work is so important. So please keep going. We support you. We just want to shout this from the rooftops. You are just changing lives, and it's an uphill battle, but man, we are behind you.
So Leonard, I know we'll put this in the show notes, but tell people briefly how they can get a hold of you, and like you come in and work with schools, yes? And talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, I provide educational support to students so that they can succeed. I bridge the relationship between students, families, teachers, and school administrators to foster a school connection and improve school culture. I do that through school assemblies, classroom presentations, professional development, and workshops. I provide the support needed to connect, empower, and grow relationships that supports behavior change and academic success. My website is intheschooltoprisonpipeline.com. The two is the number two, not the letters, the schooltoprisonpipeline.com.
Perfect.
And my email is webolutionary@gmail.com.
Any parting thoughts or final words you want to say before we end this episode?
I just want a reminder for parents and school teachers and administrators that young people are still developing, that exposure to violence and poverty and any adverse childhood experience injures the brain and make them more at risk for risky behavior. And we have to learn to teach through non-consequential behaviors and provide our children with effective strategies so they can cope. And like I said, we can't suspend our way to a positive school culture.
Amen.
Good reminder. Thank you. Thank you, Leonard. We told you this time was going to go quickly, and it has. Right. We could talk to you so much longer, but we appreciate so much what you're doing. And thanks for the important message today.
Thanks for having me.
And thanks to all of our listeners out there. We've enjoyed today, and we will catch you all in the next episode.
This has been another episode of Regulated and Relational. Join us next time when Julie and Ginger will be talking about gratitude, grounding, and glimmers. A special thanks to Lorraine Schneider, our editor, and Joe Kramer for donating our music. For more information about the Attachment and Trauma Network, visit our website at attachtrauma.org. Show notes and upcoming episodes will be available on our website and through anchor.fm. I'm Danny Pankratz. Thanks for listening.